This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris again. This is the second show that I get to do with Damien O'Farrell. He is a community organizer and social entrepreneur living in Riverside, and he is the CEO of Path of Life Ministry, the largest homeless shelter and housing provider in the county of Riverside. So welcome back. We framed some of the homelessness issue last week, and probably a lot of listeners are like, why are they covering this topic? Wait, what does it have to do with real estate investing? And we are going to get to it this time. But let's talk about misconceptions about homelessness.
Sure. Well, I think this is, thank you for asking that question, because it's important, because the misconceptions about what people are experiencing or who homeless individuals are is one of the things that either makes it more difficult or less difficult to help individuals get out of those situations, and partly due to the stigma that's attached if somebody's homeless, and especially if they have some mental health issue that they're dealing with, and there's a whole stigma that's related to that makes them afraid to ask for help. But bottom line is this, and it's a paradigm shifter for some individuals, but homelessness is a situation. It's not an identity. Okay, so there is no typical homeless person, as if all homeless people are like all any other category of people that you'd want to call.
Right.
Right? It's just,
right.
It's a situation. And if a person in a homeless situation gets into housing, they're no longer homeless. Their homelessness is solved.
Right.
Now, they may have any number of other issues or things that they need to work out in their life to remain stable and to move towards a thriving life, just like we all have.
Right.
But they're doing that within the context of a stability of a home, which, Maslow has taught us that once you have your basic needs met, you're able to start concentrating on other deeper needs, psychological needs in your life. And that's true for those in homeless situations as well, which is why Housing First works.
So Housing First, I think there is we talk a lot about the welfare system, and I think one of the things, and a lot of people say, is like, oh, they need to be drug free, they need to be off stuff, you know, before they can get social assistance. And this really flips that. And I think for a lot of people, it might be uncomfortable, because the Housing First basically says,
sure,
we take you where you're at right now, regardless of what your situation is, you put it in housing, and then you surround them with services.
Yep, exactly right.
For a landlord looking at that, I can already, you know, sense people's cringing on the other side of it. Yeah. So let's talk about that.
I'll tell you that it makes me uncomfortable too.
Okay.
Right? Because it goes against what I want to be true.
Right.
What I want to be true is that if somebody has a desire to get out of a homeless situation, they can get themselves clean or off of alcohol or drugs or whatever it is that might be contributing to their current situation, and then get into housing and stay there.
Mm-hmm.
I want that to be true, but the statistics don't show that it works all that well, because a person has to have the whereabouts to make it through and navigate that system. And if they are addicted to a substance or using that as a coping mechanism, it's much, much difficult to change that behavior when you're afraid for what's going to happen that day or where your meal's going to come from and you don't have stability. Now, how it affects the landlord is, I have to be completely honest that we've had some situations where we've had to step in and move somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, I actually have property myself, and I know a lot of other landlords, and I know that landlords have had to do that many, many times.
Right.
With tenants that they've rented to that qualified for their rents, and even worse things have happened to their properties.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't had anybody to call or turn to like our landlords have had with us. Right. And so when you look at the number one, the high degree of success and how well people take care of the places that they're in because it's so special to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at, for the rare cases, the much more rare cases where a person's struggling, the fact that they have the support structure that we provide in that program provides an additional amount of support for the landlord as well. And they're getting their check on time every month.
So this really behaves a lot like Section 8.
It behaves like Section 8, but better, I would say, because of the supportive services that come alongside that individual. Well, Section 8, they're given a voucher.
Okay.
They have to go find housing on their own, and they use that that voucher to cover a part of their rent. Mm-hmm. In our situation, the lease is still in the name of the tenant, the person that is living there. They, in many cases, are responsible for a portion of their rent, and our goal is to get them to the place where they can be responsible for the whole of their rent. But we are cutting the check. So the check, the whole amount of the rent's coming to them on time every single month, and we're insuring that. And we are continuing to walk alongside in we don't call it this, we call it navigation, but it's what's known as case management, right? We don't manage cases. We're working right alongside people, but we're helping them achieve their goals and move forward. And I can tell you story after story after story of individuals that have turned around and started volunteering, given back, become peer support specialists themselves, and just doing very well. And you would have never thought that a year and a half ago. And the landlords are very happy with them.
And I can see that being very powerful if they turn around and then volunteer their time, because there's nothing like hearing from somebody that has done it successfully themselves to get out of that situation. So let's take the journey. I'm fascinated that you're really able to get somebody with such a lifelong history of being on the streets and convince them to do this. So what does that look like? How do you outreach to them? How does that conversation even start?
That conversation starts with, hi, how are you?
So you guys are out on the streets?
Yep, building trust.
Okay.
And then a series of questions, really, which is, what do you want? What is it that you're looking for? And what we base that off of, it's kind of the core of what's known. It's a national best practice in behavioral health called motivational interviewing, and I won't get into the weeds on it. But essentially, we know that once a person is motivated to change their situation themselves, the chances are much, much more likely that they will change that situation rather than something being forced upon them. Okay. And so motivational interviewing is a process of asking questions. And so one of the ways this worked out on the field was for a gentleman, we call him Nacho. That's what he goes by. He literally, for over 20 years, lived under a bridge. And we have a picture of where he lived there. And he would chase our outreach team away and say, I don't want help. And it's really a matter of protection. He didn't want to be taken advantage of, as he later told us. But our outreach team, once they were able to build the trust, said, well, you know, what is it that you want? And he said, I'd really like a cell phone, right? He wasn't asking for housing. He was asking for a cell phone.
Okay.
Because that can be a lifeline for people that are living out in the street. And there are these free cell phones that people call Obama phones that you can get with, you know, a limited number of minutes, and they're not fancy. They're a lifeline phone that's cellular versus landline. And they said, great. Well, there's only a few things that we need to do in order to get you qualified for that. Let's do that. He got in the van with them. He went and filled out his documents and got his IDs and all those things. Mm. And he experienced a small win. This actually worked.
Okay.
Time goes on, a few more steps like that. He's in his own place, lease in his own name. He's one of our star peer support specialists now.
Wow.
Just doing very, very well. And that's the process, building trust, creating small wins, helping people see that this can actually work and reconnect with the desire in their life that they once had, maybe even as a child.
Right. And I imagine you really can't labeled everybody the same. Their journey is different. With somebody like that who's been on the streets for so long, what are their chances they have an ID? Or, you know, you don't have a mailing address. How do you even turn on something like a cell phone? You know?
Right. Yeah. And that's why people in those situations, I mean, there's studies that have been done that show what being in crisis can do to the mind, right?
Right.
And people that are in homeless situations are facing crisis all the time. They have a lot of experiences of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. They're in survival all the time, always watching their back. And so that just does something to your mind. So you have to have a certain amount of safety created for you to be even able to think differently. And without somebody to help them do that, chances are very likely that they'll do it on their own because they're physiologically not able to. It's not because it's a lack of desire. It's they're physically, physiologically not able to do it on their own. And so when people say, well, they should just, you know, pick themselves up by their bootstraps, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, well, it's a cruel thing to tell a man to pick themselves up by their bootstraps when they don't have bootstraps.
Yeah. I was about to say that. So, okay. You've gained their trust. They're ready to be placed in a home. What does the ideal home look like for you?
It's anything that that really works for them. That's, you know, it's, we're not going to put a single individual in a 5-bedroom home. We're going to put a single individual and try to find a an efficiency unit or a one bedroom unit, we're only able, there's HUD restrictions, which are good HUD restrictions that only allow us to pay up to a certain amount for a certain size of family.
Okay.
Now that's based on fair market rents, mm-hmm. which that is something that needs to be adjusted because fair market in, Barstow is not fair market in Riverside.
No, and, it is not.
that does create a difficulty for us, which I cannot blame the landlords for, not taking less money than what's available to them. Mm-hmm. However, I will say that there are ways in which, there can be a donation given that can be a tax write-off for the landlord if they're looking at that. If they charge for less than the fair market rent, they would have to, get the advice of their tax person to make sure that they're good with what they charge and everything. But there's those opportunities. And when people start to understand the connection that continuing homeless situations has to so many other areas of our economy and our quality of life, we start to learn that it is truly better for all of us if we do not have homeless individuals on the street.
Right.
So putting aside the what it does to an individual person who's homeless, mm-hmm. or what it does for them if they're out of that situation, when studies have been done that track the cost of homelessness and the cost of somebody remaining homeless, the latest study was right around $67,000 a year that it costs the community when you talk about code enforcement and you talk about police and fire calls and lack of business and medical, right?
Yeah.
And so just getting somebody out of that situation dramatically reduces the cost to the community, and that's good. Mm-hmm. Quality of life when you don't have individuals in homeless situations out in public areas is improved, and so there's a benefit there. The other thing is to understand that when people don't have homes and when they don't have homes that they can afford, they have less, even if they're in a home, but it's so highly priced that they can't afford it, they have less to spend on every other area of life. Mm-hmm. They have to work harder. They have less to invest in their children's education. When it comes to a medical bill, they're not paying, they might have to choose poorly about medical insurance and those sorts of things, and mm-hmm. might not be able to pay that medical bill. So we're all affected if we're in the insurance pool, right?
Right.
And the emergency rooms, if that's what somebody's using instead of primary care, are not available for those of us that actually have an emergency, right?
So right.
Again and again and again, you see the effects that people not having housing that they can afford has on our community. So it's really better for all of us to figure out a way to make that possible.
How many of the houses, the placements you see, are the individuals versus families?
We currently run 80 units, run meaning we work with individuals that are in 80 privately held units throughout the county, and then we have now an additional 35 families that we're working with, and so that's our ratio. There are more single individuals that are in homeless situations than there are families, family units, but the numbers of people, there's more family individuals and family units that are homeless than there are individuals.
Do you typically place individuals together, or is it very purposeful that you keep people separate?
It depends upon what works best for them.
Oh.
What's going to contribute to their longest stability.
Okay.
So we really take what's called a client-centered approach, and we want to find the best fit so that person's going to thrive in their situation.
So what does case management look like then? So you're tailoring it per person depending mm-hmm. on what their specific need is?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's partnerships with behavioral health and...
Sure. Wow. Yeah. So we have our own behavioral health team that we use kind of for triage to help people make it through that transition and provide them access, because even our behavioral health system is not all that accessible. People have to wait for weeks to get in to see their doctor. So what do they do in the meantime, right? So that's where our team of behavioral health specialists, 13 interns and marriage family therapists and led by a licensed social worker comes alongside the individuals and helps address their immediate need and then connect them to other long-term services.
Okay.
But the navigators are meeting weekly with the individuals, checking in, sometimes helping them learn basic life skills that they've never been taught to be able to take care of their place and cook for themselves and shop well and use the resources that they have to the best of their ability and budget. And then also, as as soon as they are able, we're not only a housing first, but we're also an employment first organization. So as soon as somebody is able to move towards employment, because they have the basic stability that they need to do that well, and sometimes that's even in shelter, our goal is to help get somebody employed. Mm-hmm. Working with our employment partners, employer partners, for some direct placements, providing training, certificate programs, helping somebody not only becoming employment ready, but then making the transition into employment well and stay there. So,
wow,
we're getting to see some good success.
Do they get to stay in the place long term? Is this sort of like if they want to live there for 10 years, is that the goal? Or?
Unless they violate the lease.
You know,
they can stay there as long as anybody else could.
So it's not like, oh, you've got a year to get your stuff together, then after that you're out.
So we have a rapid rehousing program. And so the permanent supportive housing is focusing on individuals with the highest barrier.
Okay.
And so that funding, as long as it's available, can provide up to 100% of their rent indefinitely.
Okay.
And we're working with them. Rapid rehousing is for individuals that need less support, a little bit more of a hand up, but within a year, our goal is to get them to the place of self-sufficiency as quickly as possible.
Oh.
But we can go from a year up to 2 years of that process with a very specific goal-oriented plan that they've created in mind to get them to that place.
What's the status of what you need as far as inside of the units? Do they need to be furnished?
They do need to be furnished.
Okay.
And so we actually have a pretty good supply of furniture, but we're always interested in others that want to provide that furniture. We have a warehouse that we draw from and help furnish the units. I mean, so including, you know, beds and couches and refrigerators that is required for somebody to move in. And that's not something that the federal funds provide the funding to cover. So all that has to come from private funds.
I laugh because a lot of rehabbers are probably laughing on their side, because it's not unusual for you to get a rehab that's been left a lot of furniture. So
Right. Is
that something that they can call and maybe drop off? Or
yep.
Okay.
If it's not something that you would be afraid to sit on or sleep on, then yes, we will take it.
We'll call that the smell test.
You know, okay. If it is, then that person exiting that homeless situation probably doesn't want to sit on it either.
Okay. Functional zero has been a word that's been tossed around. Let's cover that a little bit.
Yeah, that's important because functional zero is basically this. So if we reach functional zero in the county, for example, that means that any person that presents themselves that's in a homeless situation that wants to get out of that situation can get housed very quickly, 30, 60, maybe 90 days, right? We can get them into housing that they can afford or that's subsidized or not very quickly and out of that homeless situation.
Okay.
So we're not at functional zero for most people in our county. We are at functional zero, and we were the first large county in the nation to reach functional zero amongst veterans that are in
That's
homeless
cool.
situations.
That
very, very cool.
Really neat. And how many partnerships is that with you?
Oh,
you guys have been working
with
that specifically, or?
So we've played a part in that
by
connecting with veterans, helping do the assessments, helping find housing placements. Some of them have gone into the units that we've supported, et cetera, et cetera. But the partnerships are really extensive. City of Riverside, County of Riverside, Department of Public Social Services and EDA and Department of Mental Health or Behavioral Health, VA,
mm-hmm.
other veterans organizations, such as an organization called Lighthouse and an organization called U.S. Vets. We all came together and we tried to figure out a different way of doing this and created a by name list and strategically went through that list. But
wow.
Also say this, that the reason that was possible was one, the collaboration that I've mentioned,
mm-hmm.
tearing down silos. Let's work together. Let's figure out things that aren't working and not do those anymore and do more of the things that are. And the other thing is, so two other things. One is VASH vouchers, which is essentially Section 8 vouchers that are specifically reserved for veterans.
Oh, okay.
We provided enough VASH vouchers to help those veterans get into housing by subsidizing their housing through VASH vouchers.
Okay.
And through compassionate landlords who gave some people a break and took a risk on people. And I know it is a risk, but they took some risk on people that are in housing situations and doing very, very well because, you know, they were veterans. And so now we're looking at what's the next group of people, kind of subcategory of people that we're going to target to reach functional zero with and begin to chip away growing the number of resources to meet the number of need.
Is it a best practice if you had a wish list, would it be to go after the single family here and there, or would it be to create a building where all these individuals are in one spot?
I think small buildings with lots of units in them can be one small piece of the answer. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's best for the individual or mm-hmm. best for the community that surrounds it. And it's not because the individuals in there are bad people, but we learned some things in the 1970s with what's known as the projects.
Right.
We learned some things that don't work, and we also learned that probably the best practice other than multi-site housing, the way that we do it, is mixed income housing, where people can live next door to people that are in different situations, and we can learn from one another.
It's huge in New York, and I don't understand why it hasn't been quite as popular on the West Coast.
Hard to fund.
Yeah, and I'm sure the builders in New York get different tax breaks from the city government for doing that. So
that's exactly
if you're an artist in New York City, I know some friends who have been on Broadway, and their income is very inconsistent, but man, you get one of those units, and it's just a lifelong gift. It's crazy.
Yep.
So I know we're starting to run out of time, and if landlords are interested in getting involved in something like this, where should they be going?
Well, they can certainly reach out to us at www.thepathoflife.com and just or send an email to housing@thepathoflife.com and say, you know, I'm a landlord of however many units, big or small, and I'd like to talk with you more about this.
Okay.
We're in the process of bringing on a landlord specialist that can really sit down with every landlord and help them through the process of determining what might be the best use of their property if they want to work with us in that.
Okay.
So we're not there yet, but we can still offer that service, and we have individuals in the real estate industry on our board that have done this. They've had great experiences with this, and they can help walk them through the process.
Okay.
I think the important thing to note is that if we make housing available for people in our community, if we're willing to maybe think outside the box just a little bit, I think that we can really all benefit, not just those that go into the housing, but those that are interested in real estate investment as well, real estate development, because it makes the community stronger.
And you said right now the smaller units are a little bit of more interest to you at the moment?
I would say both, because we have some large families. I mean, we are interested in all size units. And it's really important to have a good flow, because if, you know, we never know who we might be working with. And so to have a kind of a menu of options that might be available, and we're not expecting anybody to hold the unit vacant, to wait for us, but we can get people into units pretty quickly when they're available.
Is there any other kind of landlord education that, I mean, I had never really heard of this until because I know you, I'm actually learning a lot today. Is there any of the resources for maybe some listeners that aren't local? Maybe they're in San Francisco. Absolutely. Or Sacramento.
So maybe one of the best resources that's related specifically to housing first and homelessness and the use of housing in mutually beneficial ways is the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Mm-hmm. They have some really great resources that somebody can check out, and they can also be connected to a number of different agencies throughout the country that are utilizing this practice, doing it well, and would love to connect with somebody on a local level.
Have we talked about the success rate of people that have gone into this kind of housing?
No, we haven't. But it's an important thing to talk about as well, because the national average for success of people staying in their housing after getting there through one of these programs is up over 85%. Which is really high.
That is.
I mean, traditional models of forcing people to figure it out on their own are in the low 40s, right?
Wow.
So to go from that to up to 85% is really huge. Now, we've had closer to a 99% success rate. We've only operated the programs that we've operated for a couple of years now. So, you know, it's early on, but we're seeing success.
That's really great. Well, with that, we are out of time, and you have an upcoming event. What's the date?
Thank you. June 3rd,
okay.
Held at Riverside Medical Clinic on the corner of Arlington and Brockton in the city of Riverside. It's called the Pub and Grub Challenge, and so a really, really fun event featuring men who cook. There's community groups that come out and cook small bites, and the community gets to come in and test all the food and vote on the best, and we have some celebrity chefs that are will be selecting some best dishes. We also have some people that are competing in a brewing competition, so there'll be brew tastings and some live music, Corvette show, and Miss California will be there if anybody has interest in that. So
wow, that sounds like a great event. Low calorie too.
And that's right, isn't it? It's really, really fun. So 4 to 8 p.m. on June 3rd
at
Riverside Medical Clinic.
Got it. All right, well, thank you for your time. Thanks for coming out.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.